That I can hear me. Let's see if I can.
Okay, you can hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Good.
Okay. Okay. So today is February 13th, 2014. And this is Karen Brewster and Dave Klein continuing on our journey through Dave's life and career.
More or less.
And, we left off last time where you had been working at the Kenai Moose Range for the summer, just before, in between undergraduate and graduate. And I just wanted to review, before we go on, your undergraduate degree is a degree in what?
Wildlife management.
Okay. And what kind of courses did you focus on?
Well, there was a forestry and wildlife department was within the, in the plant sciences college, I guess it was called. And my courses were heavy on botany, including systematic botany. I had courses in horticulture, which I had an interest area there, and but also animal population dynamics and physiology, animal physiology and comparative anatomy, and I think I took a course in agronomy as well as forestry, some forestry courses like forest ecology, and not specifically ecology, I don't think, but yeah.
That sounds quite broad.
It was broad, and also it was more basic than a lot of state universities. A lot of them were more applied courses emphasis, but there was basic biology was important, sometimes labeled as forest ecology, as forests and ecology and forest ecology, and it was a good reputation for the forestry school. Mm-hmm. And I mixed. The students were mixed, which was good, healthy for both of us to get a forest ecology and management exposure along with the wildlife
mm-hmm.
management.
So you felt like that was a good program? You got a good education there?
Yeah, especially in retrospect when I realized what other schools offered. And when I was a cooperative wildlife unit leader later, then I did look into in more detail other wildlife units in different universities and how it related to their, whether they were more of applied versus basic biology in their academic associations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so you graduated in the spring of 1951?
That's correct.
Okay, and so you started here at UAF as a graduate student?
I came up to work on the Kenai that summer, and then I started officially in the fall. I had been accepted into the program at the University of Alaska before admission, beginning coursework, and coming and on campus at the fall of 51. Yeah.
Okay, so. Why did you decide to come to Fairbanks for the graduate work?
Well, there were several reasons. One, I had applied to, I wanted to get, come to a place where I could get some, I applied for a stipend or financial support as at schools where I wanted to attend. And it was either Alaska, because I had sort of fallen in love with Alaska and thought it was a great place, and I figured any program here, even though it was a new one, would be a good place for me. But I didn't know what funding might be available. Mm-hmm. And then I applied at, I think it was the University of Idaho and the University of, I think it was Utah State University. And in both of those, I got sort of favorable responses. Both of those non-Alaska ones, I got favorable responses in terms of narrowing down the applications for the positions, because there was a fellowship associated with those. And one was studying sage grouse population. I think that was Idaho. And the other one, seemed to me, was another, wasn't as well defined, and that might have been Utah. But it sounded acceptable, except that they weren't Alaska. And, and Alaska response was, yeah, I had all these qualifications, like having experience in Alaska and interest and knowing what I was getting into was important. And my undergraduate record was good. So the head of the wildlife unit then, Neil Hosley, he said, yeah, they would accept me, but they didn't have funding for that first year. That they could accept me, but they just didn't have enough funding. They were a brand new unit, wildlife unit, and they had very limited financial support. Mm-hmm. And this was some state money, I think, that they had available, or territorial money, I guess, at the time. So I kind of, once I got that kind of a response, I figured I would go there and find work, part-time work on campus and whatever. I figured I could do that. I had carpentry talents and other talents, and to me, I knew the campus, and I liked it, even though it was a very small university. I figured it would be a good deal. And finally did, I wrote letters to the other two places and said I had made this decision. And I got a response from, I think, Idaho, saying, they were disappointed because they were narrowing it down and I was one of the finalists for the other. Now, I think that was a sage-grouse study. And all I could say is that it gave me some feeling of confidence that I had. My qualifications were pretty good to get the possibility of getting that far along.
Yeah.
Another one, but there was no comparison. Once it was Alaska, I made up my mind, that was it.
Yeah, well, you'd been to Fairbanks already, so you knew you liked it here.
Yeah, definitely, and I'd seen a little bit of Alaska, got into the Brooks Range, and I was already hooked on, especially mountain ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And mountain ungulates, definitely, mountain sheep, mountain goats, but anything that was related to large mammals then.
Yeah.
Herbivores, and part of my training in botany was I was interested in the plant-animal relationships of these animals and how they could exist in the mountains, for example, in the Arctic and subarctic, and dependent upon vegetation in the short growing season. That interest was there, but it had to grow more before I finally got into it.
Well, I would say, what about those Arctic ungulates and herbivores? What got you excited about them?
About the what?
About the ungulates and the herbivores. Why those species? Why did they excite you?
I think because they're charismatic species, for one thing. But I had enough of this understanding that there was a relationship between plant animals, herbivores, and their food supply. I think that came from my training experience, farm work and animals, working with dairy animals, and realizing that food is what is driving all of the productivity of these animals, especially dairy animals, where, you know, the dairy products and everything were, and that's related to reproduction. And so it's easier to translate that into the wild with members of the deer family, for example, or the cattle group. And plus, back in New England, Yeah, deer were very scarce when I worked in the state forest in Connecticut. It was closed to hunting. There was some poaching going on, but the deer were very wary, scarce. I'd see their tracks, and occasionally I'd see one, but they were extremely wary. And I knew that where I'd grown up as a boy in Vermont, that, as we went north, there were more deer there, and deer hunting was popular there in those areas. But I was interested, and you learn a lot about from my grandfather on the farm about deer coming and eating apples and stuff. And yeah, the deer were hunted, and were locals would hunt them, but they were also farmers usually, and that was a sort of supplemental to their, they didn't have to kill one of their meat-producing animals.
So you say the farmers would hunt deer so they didn't have to kill one of their cattle? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think it was generally true of farmers that they would hunt, and sometimes deer might be damaging crops, and so they would rationalize their shooting for that purpose, but also they saw them as a meat that's produced on the land, some of their own land, but it was they had to comply with the state regulations.
Right.
So in North America, at least at that time, wildlife belonged to the state or the people via the state, and even the landowner would get sometimes priority for hunting, but they had to comply with harvest regulations.
Right. Right.
In contrast to Europe, for example.
So why were there more deer in Vermont than in Connecticut?
Because there were less, it was less intensively developed by humans. So the Connecticut had gone through the agriculture era and become more industrialized and more large-scale agriculture. Whereas Vermont, it was more small-scale agriculture and lower density of humans and a lot more forested land that existed there still.
Okay. So when you came to UAF in 1951, how long had the wildlife management program been going on?
1 year.
Oh,
they started in 1950, the wildlife unit, and then the university also agreed in a cooperative agreement that allowed for the establishment of the wildlife unit, where it was the university had to come up with office and secretarial support, and office space and secretarial support, and then the Fish and Wildlife Service provided the salary for the unit leader, and then the State Department of Fish and Game provided a stipend contribution for support of graduate student stipends.
Oh, okay.
So that, not sure what it was initially, it was just a few thousand, like maybe 15 or 20,000, maybe 25,000 by the state. And that was federal aid in wildlife restoration funds, or what, Pittman-Robertson funds. That it was a territory then.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. It was a territory then. But they still qualified for those funds.
So Pittman-Robertson funds?
Yeah. Wildlife in conservation and restoration was the official name of the legislation, and Pittman-Robertson were the names of the two congressional members that sponsored it.
And that was money to help the...
That was firearms and ammunition, primarily tax on firearms and ammunition.
And the money had to be used for what purpose?
Well, coming to the university, had to be used by the Department of by the Game Division or the state or territory in that case to support graduate training in to be wildlife managers.
Okay.
So the thesis projects were supported, and the thesis projects were frequently research related to basic understanding of Alaska's wildlife species. It was pretty basic understanding of ecology and productivity of wildlife species.
Mm-hmm. So was the field of wildlife management already fairly well established in this country?
Yeah, it was. You could say that Aldo Leopold was sort of the father of wildlife management. He published the first book on wildlife management called Game Management, and that was in the 1940, early 1940s, I think, that was published. But he had developed his understanding of wildlife ecology and relationship to land use practices. So he was his focus was primarily wise land use practices, and then simulated by the mistakes made during the rush to develop the West, where they had the Dust Bowl, they didn't know about cover crops, and they didn't know contour planting and planting. And in the Southwest, then he began to run into the wildlife management issues, where predator control was stimulated by the fact that farmers didn't want the predators around to kill the livestock, but they also rationalized that there would be more wildlife to hunt if they reduced the predators, and then they were major problems. Some of them were competition for grazing and lands in the forests, in the national forests, and wildlife. And the predators were the big losers, but also so were the farmers and the wildlife species, the herbivores, because this led to overgrazing, and then the blames was put on hunters for a while, and then on predation and the lack of predation. He began to see the role of predators in the ecology, especially in forest lands. Mm-hmm. And then he became sort of an activist in trying to educate the public and working with local people who were mainly hunters. They were hunters, not necessarily mainly hunters. They were hunters, but they also had other jobs. Some of them were businessmen. Some of them were other people working for the federal government or new state government.
Mm-hmm. So your undergraduate education, were you exposed to these concepts that Aldo Leopold had been writing about?
Yeah, we used this book, Game Management, as a textbook, and the people that in my undergraduate work, my wildlife professor, Franklin McKamey, was trained on the era of when Aldo Leopold was a professor, also a professor at the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a connection, and it was an era when the conservation and wise use of resources was receiving a lot of attention from mistakes made, and especially poor land use practices, especially in the eastern prairies, where erosion with water erosion was an important factor. Mm-hmm. If there was poor practices in grazing all of the riparian vegetation on streams by cattle, because they let the cattle access to the stream and you didn't have to water them, but they also ate up the aquatic vegetation, stayed around the water hole if it was real dry conditions, and gradually and destroyed the rich wildlife habitat that was unique to riparian areas, which was important for deer as well as smaller wildlife.
Yeah, they destroyed those banks, all those cattle, the terrible bank erosion.
Yeah, the bank erosion, but also in the more level ground along streams, when you get, if you didn't have a good cover crop and you got fall rains, you get erosion in the fields and cutting channels down to the streams.
Right.
And so you get big channels, and the main thing was washing away the high quality soil. The prairie soils would be washed away in a dust bowl. There was a lot of bone away, and on top of that, those dust storms in the 30s were tremendous. It would be dark all the way back into the eastern U.S. from the dust in the air that was leaving in. The amount of soil that was blown away was overwhelming.
Yeah.
And it was the most nutritious topsoil.
Yeah. Okay, so you come to Fairbanks. Even though they don't have any money for you, you come here anyway as a graduate student.
Right.
And did you have a project in mind that you wanted to work on?
From my experience in Kenai, I got exposure to the work that was being done by the territorial government on the various wildlife species, the moose. There were people based in Anchorage mainly that working with moose, and then there's someone working with the mountain sheep. The fellow was, they had other responsibilities working with the Fish and Wildlife Service related to wildlife management, but they were doing their own, they tended to partition out research activities and interests to these senior or only biologists they had at the time. And those, like one would be responsible for moose work throughout Alaska.
Wow.
And another one would be responsible for caribou, another one for mountain sheep, the species that were important to sport hunting.
Yeah. Well, I remember you mentioned in the work in the Kenai Refuge, you were doing some mountain sheep work and working with a particular biologist.
Yeah, that was Robert Scott, or Bob Scott. He had a master's degree from Oregon State in wildlife management, and he was doing a study on sort of statewide. He worked they were in the Tanana Hills on mountain sheep, the White Mountains, as well as the Alaska Range, and then the Talkeetnas, Chugach, and Kenai.
Wow.
And so he was the mountain sheep person. And I was sort of responsible to him when I was working on mountain sheep in the mountains. But I was involved in some of the moose work, including trying controlled burns to improve moose habitat.
Yeah, that's right.
And was familiar with the moose habitat work that was there. And other wildlife activities, there were a lot of focus on waterfowl, but that was so widespread in the state. That's where Dave Spencer, the refuge manager at the Kenai, was responsible for flying waterfowl breeding pair counts in the spring, and they were starting to do banding in different places, and he had a lot of responsibility there, as well as some of the other Balchus had joined with him on that based out of Anchorage. Fairbanks was a focal point for working with caribou mostly. But it was some of both. And then there were these other species that required their attention, but ironically, bison in the Delta area that were introduced species, but because there were agriculture interests plus military base and potential problems of these bison wandering around. One of the problems I remember was falling into a basement of someone who was building a cabin. And it took the military and others help before they could get this bison out.
Well, it's interesting how you say in that time period that one biologist would take a species and cover the whole state. And now they have very small areas. You know, you've got lots of caribou biologists all over the state, or lots of moose biologists. They don't cover the whole state with
one
person.
It was a combination of the fact that they didn't have that many people employed, and it made sense if they're going to be studying a given species, they could have the responsibility. They might be able to hire some field assistants or technicians or later on additional biologists, but one more senior biologist would then remain doing this. And this had some effect on the Cooperative Wildlife Unit in that at that time it was like I would have been happy to work with mountain sheep for my master's thesis because I was doing some of that. But it was like, well, that's under the control of the and the research would be under the control of the biologist in charge of that, Robert Scott. And whereas the other mountain ungulate that wasn't getting attention on the Kenai where I was or anywhere else in Alaska was the mountain goat. And so that was okay for me to do a master's project on something like that, even though my advisor was the professor had been hired as a professor, the first wildlife professor for the university at the time the wildlife unit was established. And when the director, Neil Hosley, was asked to be the dean of the university, he took that position, and then the John Buckley, who had been hired originally from New York State, and he took over as the wildlife unit leader. And so he was my major advisor, and his interest area, his own research interests, and for the unit was primarily the waterfowl and fur bearer management, which were important issues, and they didn't have, you know, that could be partitioned out to different thesis projects, mm-hmm. and it made sense. Plus, a major study area was the Minto Flats, which was so close to Fairbanks, the logistic costs of getting students out there and having a working area made good sense. But it didn't make good sense from the standpoint of my interest in alpine ungulates. And so I had a hard time convincing him that would be okay for me to do this project, and he would be it was stretching him to as my advisor, mm-hmm. and he wouldn't be able to spend as much time in the field or virtually any time in the field with me. But I felt I had the others already made contacts with people like Dave Spencer and Bob Scott that would be like ad hoc advisors. And he understood that, and I did. And fortunately, it worked out that way.
Mm-hmm. So was John Buckley the only professor in the wildlife department?
The only one that was working specifically at that time. But when he moved in to be the unit leader, he vacated the position, and that the person that was hired to teach the wildlife courses was Jim Reardon, who later became primarily a writer, but he was a professor there, and although I didn't take courses from him because I'd taken those courses in my undergraduate that he taught, but I got to know him quite well, and he was a nice person. If you had wanted any advice or help, it was nice to have him around. But it was Neil Hosley, although he was dean, he was still remained one of the advisors for me, and I think he was on my graduate committee, as well as I think Bryna Kessel, who was hired to teach ornithology and mammalogy courses. So she was a young PhD from Cornell University, was hired to do this.
So your graduate committee was Neil Hosley, Bryna Kessel, and...
I'll have to check my thesis to verify that, but I'm pretty sure that was the case.
And John Buckley?
Yeah, he was my major advisor.
So when the program first started, Neil Hosley was the faculty member?
He was the dean of the... Okay. No, he was the head of the wildlife unit.
Okay.
He was hired by the Fish and Wildlife Service to be that.
And so he was the only guy.
Yeah, but the cooperative agreement, John Buckley was hired about the same time by the university.
Oh, I see.
For that. That was part of the cooperative agreement that they had to establish... the academic program had to have a professor of wildlife.
So Fish and Wildlife paid for the unit leader, and the university then started hiring faculty around this.
Yeah.
And Buckley was the first faculty.
Yeah.
And then Hosley moved to be dean of...
Of the university.
Of natural
research. Dean of students, I guess it was called.
Okay. Yeah. And then Buckley became unit leader.
Yep.
And Reardon was the faculty.
Yep, that's right.
Okay. And so tell me about your first year as a graduate student.
Well, it was not off to a great start because I'd had this wonderful summer and I arrived on campus and raring to go, and then I had established a close friendship with the head of animal husbandry in the agriculture program. I'll come up with that name in a moment. And he was a great guy, and he was had done on sort of a moonlighted homesteading down on the Chena Pump Road, and worked at nights on the night shift to make this money to carry on this other activity for the pump station there. It became the pump house, and he was as a recently married, and he and his wife from Utah, and they were just about to start a family. And so he was building this house at that time on this that he'd homesteaded. They'd already lived on a small cabin that they'd built on skids and moved down there and proved up on the land by that time. And he had actually, I think, a few cows that he was starting a dairy herd, and he was still holding down the job at the university, and in my view, doing a good job at that as well. Yeah. But he was needed some finished work and kitchen cabinets in this house he was building, and he said, oh, I could work for him on that part time when I had time. So, first time he took me down, dropped me off there in the afternoon when I had the afternoon. I didn't have classes. And I started working, and I got sick.
Uh-oh.
I had a terrible upset stomach, I thought. And it got worse and worse, and I finally just sat down on the floor and waited for him to come back. And when he was going to pick me up on the end of the day, which he did, and I said, I got this problem. And so he took me to the university sort of infirmary where there was a nurse, a trained nurse, Miss Fish, and she did a quick examination. She didn't like the looks of things. She thought it could be appendicitis.
Yeah.
And so she got me into the hospital, the old hospital.
St. Joseph's?
St. Joseph's. And the doctor was Haglund. Dr. Haglund. And he was about the only doctor at that time that was doing surgery and delivery of babies and what. And he said, yeah, I was pretty sure. And so he did the operation. And then it looked like I was everything went well, and then I was about ready to go back. And I think maybe I don't know whether I went back to the infirmary or I was about to. But then I was not passing food, and. But I had a good appetite, apparently, and so that was a big problem. And so then what was happening, I was getting peritonitis. Ooh. And paralysis of the lower digestive tract. So they had to do stomach pumps several times and put me back on intravenous. And I almost didn't make it. Yeah. Because they it would get worse and worse. I couldn't, had a hard time sleeping. They would put me on morphine, and people would come in to fellow students, and John Buckley would come in to visit me, and I was feeling okay, and gradually it was worse and worse, and I began to realize that it was getting. It would be a very life-threatening situation, and the doctor couldn't do anything because they couldn't go in again and operate. It would be too, and they couldn't do anything with. They just provided drugs and hope for the best, and stomach pumps several times, and the paralysis got worse. And. And finally, they moved me into a private room and sent in the priest, or the priest came in, wanted to know if I would appreciate having him say some things over me, and which I said, no thanks. And he said, you know, how about a Protestant preacher I could get to come in? And I said, no, I don't think so. And So then I got paralysis so that I could no longer pee, and they had to get a male nurse, which was hard to find, to come in and put a catheter in to relieve that pressure, which that was great relief, but I was still going downhill. And I was in there for a couple of days, and finally, I detected, I think I farted. When the nurse, I knew what that meant, and the nurse came in and said, how are you doing? And I said, I think I farted. She said, oh, that's wonderful. So that was a turnaround, and it only took a few days before I was eating again, and they moved me onto campus, and Miss Fish kept her eye on me, and so then she she was feeding me at first, and then she let me go to the cafeteria, and then they were having a big special roast pork dinner. Mm-hmm. And so she let me go to that, and I ate too much.
Uh-oh.
And I came back, and I had horrible stomach pains.
Yeah.
And she really scolded me badly for that. And so, but from then on, I had lost, I was down to about 150 pounds, I think. So I'd lost about 35 pounds. And I recovered very rapidly. But then I had all those courses, and where the teachers were good and had loaned me their notes for lectures and their outline and assigned me reading to catch up, which I did. I was taking, I think, mammology and two or three other courses, and I was able to do pretty well, partly because I was dedicating myself fully to this. But then after that, when I got caught up, then this job opened up to that was through, again, through Lynn Hollis. He was the agricultural animal husbandryman, and he knew that I had taken a course in dairy husbandry and had worked when I was up here the first year with the dairy farm.
Yeah.
So he knew I had training in pasteurization, and they had just built a small building on campus, like a very small building with the modern pasteurization equipment, and the milk from the agricultural station was served in the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. And so they needed someone to pasteurize it, and so I had the job of getting up early. As soon as the milking was over in the morning, a truck would bring the milk cans over to this and drop them off in front of the pasteurization plant. I would get up in time, probably about 5:30 in the morning, and pasteurize the milk, and then run it through the cooler, and then put it in containers to take to the cafeteria on campus, which is just a short distance away, and I could carry them over, and they fit right in the milk dispenser machines. Mm-hmm. And then I carried on the rest of the day, but that paid me well, and I had to learn to get up
early.
I had to learn to work, use my time efficiently, and study hard, and I did well.
So how long were you sick and in the hospital with that? How much time did you miss from school?
I think all I can say is several weeks, but I don't know how much it was, like maybe a third of the semester.
But it was several weeks, not several months.
No, it wasn't several months, but it was probably over a month before I was back onto the schedule.
Right. Well, didn't, when you were here in Fairbanks the first time, when you drove up with your buddy, didn't you spend that winter and work at the dairy milking cows?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were familiar with cows and milk.
And had taken a course in dairy husbandry.
Okay.
And knew about pasteurization.
Okay.
Knew how to do it.
Yeah. So it was everybody's all about sustainability, and there we were. You were drinking the milk in the cafeteria from your own cows.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the little of the history of the agricultural experiment station, it was, you know, technically it was a U.S. government facility,
mm-hmm.
but the first president of the university, Bunnell, there was this close relationship between the university and the experimental station. And that, and of course, the when I was there, the it was because the professors in agriculture at that early on were they were split between working through the experimental station and the university. Well, there were some complaints made from the standpoint of the research station and being a research station for the federal government, and Bunnell, in effect, was making use of it to produce cheap food for the cafeteria to keep the tuition down for the students, and yeah, the, so it was mainly milk, but it included some of the meat production that was result from pork. Was they were doing experiments on feeding different foods to pork, and then they'd slaughter a bunch of pork, and it was all some of that was available for use in the cafeteria, and crop production probably not so much. There might have been some, but there were also opportunities where the experimental station was working with the farmers and early homesteaders here that were getting into crop production, and so they would frequently work out the university was somewhat of a market for some of that produce, but it had to be it was easier for the university to buy that through the experimental farm rather than marketing it through stores downtown that had shipped stuff in. But yeah, some of it went both places. For Bunnell, he was a doer, and he'll get things done in a positive way.
Right.
he was impressed. I know him a bit, and I thought he was a pretty good guy, because he was all for the university and for the students as well.
So when you came, where were you living as a graduate student? Did you live on campus?
Yeah, I lived in the dorm, actually that first year I lived it was student housing. It was old military Quonsets that were left over from the Second World War military, when the university was teaching military courses too. And they were sort of temporary buildings and not the greatest for being heated effectively. But then I think the next year I moved into a room in the main dorm, which was mostly us grad students, a few bachelor faculty, maybe some senior students as well.
So where were those old military Quonsets located?
They were Hess Hall. They were just to the west of Hess Hall. There was a hockey rink there, and they were just on the north side of the hockey rink, just down below the old faculty housing that's above the Chapman Building.
Okay.
So in that area, yeah. The Chapman Building, it was built during that period of time.
And the main dorm, where was that?
There was club dorm, main dorm, and there were three dorms, I think, wooden frame dorms for males, and then Hess Hall for females. These were old wooden frame buildings, and one of them had the cafeteria in the basement. I forget which one that was. I think that was club dorm.
And so that those buildings are located where now the current lower campus dorms are, but behind the Lola Tilly Commons, or they're the ones up on the ridge?
Let me see. I think they would have been just a little, probably just about where the Greening building is
okay,
now.
Yeah.
And a little bit, and then if you go west of that, then that would be where Hess Hall was.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's that one dorm, I forget what name of it.
There's a Wickersham?
Wickersham, yeah.
Yeah, so that area. Okay.
Yeah.
That's close enough.
Yeah.
I need to go read Terrence's book about the history of campus. It's probably all in there, that where those buildings
probably,
are.
Probably, yeah. And there was another one done by a earlier professor on the campus, I think.
Hmm. So how many students were in the wildlife program when you started?
There were about six, because the first one was John Hockala. He was the first to graduate, and then Sal De Leonardis also came just before I did, and then the rest of us, there was Cal Lenzink, myself, Dave Hooper, and I think that was it in the first year. And then the next year there were people like Les Ferrick, who was in that program for 1 year before he decided he wanted to be a botanist. And then Ted LaShelt.
Mm-hmm.
Ed, what was his name? The fisheries, did a master's in fisheries in Grayling.
I'm sorry, I can't help you.
it'll come back.
Okay.
Because I shared a room with him one time, too, with Gal Lensick one semester as well.
So when did you start this mountain goat project? Tell me about that project.
Well, then I planned for the next summer to go down there to the Kenai again, because I was already familiar with mountain goat habitat, knew where it was, and had visited briefly with Dave Spencer, and with the idea that I would... There was no funding for that yet, but I had been assured some help from aircraft support occasionally from Dave Spencer and Fish and Wildlife Service, maybe. But I also realized I had to do this sort of on the side while I was doing mountain sheep. Section age ratio counts for Scott. So he employed me as a field technician. And so I worked in the White Mountains, like a week to 10 days at a time. Then I'd move into the Alaska Range and then into the Talkeetnas and Chugach, just out of Anchorage, just going, well, I'd move down to Anchorage and then work out of there for the Talkeetnas and especially the Chugach, because it was so close to Anchorage. And then on the Kenai, when I would be based there. And then I would have some free time sometimes, and I would then go hike into the mountain sheep areas. And Dave Spencer went in with me to the one of the first areas with me to get me familiar with it, started and familiar with climbing around the mountains in the summertime safely. And then I carried on by myself and worked in those mountains. But then things came up so that I could there was a project where they wanted to release mountain goats on Kodiak Island. And so they said they could pay me full schedule as a field assistant to join that project. I did two with two guys who were predator and rodent control people, and they were, you know, very senior people and terrific field people. And so the three of us were flown out to Day Harbor, which is just to the east of Resurrection Bay out of Seward. And we set up a tent camp there, and we were going to try to capture young mountain goats with snares, leg snares, with rope. And so we had to climb up into the mountains. It was kind of rugged, but once you get up there, you could get around. And there were goats there. And unfortunately, it's kind of expected that the goats were in goat habitat, and they were pretty familiar with goat habitat. Goats were, and we weren't. But we didn't have any good situation, couldn't find any good situations for putting out snares. And then the ewes had new lambs, new kids, and which stayed with them. And the billies were up higher in the mountains and weren't in that area. And we came close to getting able to lasso a kid once, but luckily we weren't successful because we learned a lot of things about goats. And with a couple of females with kids, we discovered it lower than we were, and when we were hiking around, and so we thought they were going to come up and onto this trail where they'd gotten down there, and if we could get a rope, this one of these guys had worked as a cowboy, and he could lasso and throw a pretty good lasso, and he thought he could maybe lasso one of these kids. Mm-hmm. So he was a good place where he could get behind this rock outcrop and where the goats were going to work their way up. And the other fellow and I were higher up, and I had a camera, pretty good used Leica, and we were up there and down so we couldn't be seen, and we were watching all this, and I did get a couple of slides when this one ewe and the kid came up there, and when the kid went by, I'll think of his name, the guy's name, but anyway, he threw this lasso, and he came close, but that you just came right for him, threatened him. And they got sharp horns, and they're pretty good size. And of course, the kid ran, and so he kind of started pulling in this rope and moving back to get close to this rock that he could maybe get behind it, and big rock. And in the meantime, the lamb started running back down the slope a little bit on the real steep slope, and so the ewe took off with it and went away. And the two of them, the others, they finally worked their way up another way and disappeared. But it was obvious that you weren't going to take a kid from a ewe without being under control of the you, and we weren't prepared, nor did we want to or have permission to shoot the you. And it wasn't the best idea anyway, because we had to get some way to feed this kid and get it down the mountain and then get it flown out, and then it'd have to be taken care of. And that would be a difficult operation. So that that was a failed operation. But and the Fish and Wildlife Service thought that the best way to get these was animals was to get some of these old timers down in that area that had a lot of familiarity with goats and trapping and hunting, and offer so much money for a yearling.
Like a bounty, kind of?
Yeah, they would get captured alive. I think they were paying $400, which was pretty good money.
Yeah.
But, of course, it was realized that they'd have to be innovative. And so, but in that summer before it went put into practice, and I was, Dave Spencer wanted to do some sheep and goat surveys, which was great for me, and took me along. And one of the areas where I was working, then we were able to do these surveys, and we were flying pretty high over Cooper Lake, and I looked down and I saw what looked to be three swans, because there were these white things in swimming in the lake. And the lake is sort of hourglass shaped, and the bottom and the neck, there was these swans. And so Dave swooped down a little lower, and it was goats swimming across the lake, and from one mountain to the other. So they were way above tree line. Mm-hmm. And so he quickly lost altitude and landed and tried to head these goats. They were getting close to one shore, tried to head them off. Well, it wasn't quite fast enough to get all three turned, but we got the last one turned, and we got between it and the shore. The other two got to shore and ran up the mountain. And so Dave said, grab a rope and go up through underneath and into the bow, open the cockpit, and take this rope and try to get it around the horns of this goat, which was swimming, and it was trying to get to shore, of course, but we were able to, we could taxi, slide slowly right up close to it, and he had to cut the engines completely, and it was just sheer luck, and I was able to get out there and got the rope around the horns and tightened it up. And so I had a control of this goat, and of course it couldn't do much because it was in the water swimming. And so he said he would then put the wheels down and taxi up and so they hit bottom and we get in shallower water, and then we'd have to go in and horse this goat out onto the beach so where we could handle it. So that's what we did, and we both leaped over into the water. As soon as that goat could get its feet on the bottom, it was starting to bounce, you know.
Yeah.
But we had its head and horns, had a good grip on that with the rope, and so we had to hold it close to the boat at first. So we both jumped over. I think I did first, and Dave did, and we were able to, he on one side and me on another, both on these horns. It was a young male, and it had horns about it was probably about 3 years old.
So is that what, like 6 inches?
Yeah, 5 inches, five inches, but good solid horns. And we got it, the main thing was to get it up on shore, and then Dave had had grabbed a parka and threw that up on shore, an old parka. And so then we got it over on the parka, and each of us grabbed the feet and got it down. And then I had to hold the horns, and we used some of this rope right away and could tie it on two front feet together and then find the back feet and pull those together so it couldn't bound around. Mm-hmm. And then it went back to the plane and got some more rope. And we, in the meantime, we could put part of the parka over its head so it couldn't see anything, and it mm-hmm. would calm down a bit once we covered its head. And then we had to carry it back and put it in the plane, and we flew it to Kenai. And the plan was, it was too late to fly to Kodiak that same day, so we put it in this old shed that was sort of like a Quonset, like a big one, a garage, mm-hmm. and had a good sound door and had a workbench, and it was wide open and wooden plank floor, and we tied it to this bench, and so and we took the we kept the line on the horns and made it more secure, and then but we tied it with plenty of room, and once we took the rope off the feet, it just leaped immediately up onto the bench and stood there. And so we went out and brought in some, we found some straw and put it on the floor and got water, put it in there. And I think we might have found some grain or something, but I don't know whether it ate it. I think it knocked over it over. Mm-hmm. We didn't know whether it ate anything. And we picked some green vegetation and put it in there. It might have eaten, but we don't know about that. So the next morning we got up early and had a little trouble capturing the goat again, but we did. And we flew it to Kodiak, right into the head of a bay, where base of a mountain, where they wanted to do the releases of any goats on this mountain. And we just took the goat out and released it there right at the high tide line, and it immediately went into the alders and started to climb up on the hill. And so when we flew back, we'd put an ear tag in it, but flew back to Kenai. So that was a significant contribution, but it takes more than one male. So then they were successful, and there was one guy out of Seward, and he had a nickname, I can't remember it, that was sort of fit him. And he had a boat, and he did some trapping and hunting, and he started trying to capture goats. And he did, he was successful. He put, when the goats came down in the winter and would be on these narrow trails along on the cliffs, mm-hmm. he built these, make a snare out of nylon rope and tie it to a big block of wood so that it couldn't be taken very far, and it would try to do that in the alders where it wouldn't go come crashing down the beach. And so he was able to capture, I think, two of them that way, two young goats. And of course, in snow, it was a lot easier to handle them if you could get them down into the snow. It was sort mm-hmm. of like having them in the water in soft snow. And he was a big, burly guy, but he did this all by himself.
Wow.
And he brought in these goats, and those were taken down. And then...
So those his were taken to Kodiak also?
Yeah. And there were some others caught later, but shortly after these first couple, I was there on the Kenai, and I'd been climbing in the mountains in goat habitat, and And he was trying, this was in the springtime when there was still snow, but you could get around pretty well. Lakes were still frozen, but they could hike around because the trails were pretty solid, melting but hard-packed snow. And so I was planning to go into Seward a day or two. I was only about 30 miles from Seward. And then I came down, talked to someone there at near Cooper Lake where I was staying and with the Forest Service, and he said, well, did you hear that this guy had been butted off a cliff by a goat?
Wow.
And he's in the hospital. So I went to Seward, and I visited this fellow in the hospital. And he'd broken some ribs, and he'd, I think one arm was fractured. And he was in the hospital, and he'd fallen down into the alders and Devil's Club that was sticking through the snow. So he was pretty, a lot of scratches all over his face. He was such a game guy, it's unbelievable. And he said, problem was, it was a bigger goat than he really wanted, and it turned out it was not in his snare. It was on a ledge, a narrow ledge that had come down, and he had worked his way around, and the goat felt quite secure on this ledge.
Oh, right.
And he had lowered himself down onto the ledge, thinking it was in a snare, and couldn't move, and the goat just butted him off the cliff.
And this was the guy, the trapper hunter who'd captured the goats before,
yeah.
And you can't remember his name.
No, and he went back. I might be able to find it. I do have field diaries somewhere. I think they're in the office. He went back. He said he was going to go back and try to capture more, and I think he did capture one or two more.
So was it successful? Are there now mountain goats in Kodiak?
Yeah. They have a hunting season. They're limited distribution. They do have a hunting season. And I've seen them from the air when I've been down there at times.
So this field tech for Bob Scott and working with the sheep, that was your first summer while you were in graduate school, or did you do that during...
The first summer, and I did it some in the second summer as well.
Okay.
So I fit that in with this other goat stuff, which was good because I was still dependent for logistic support, any flying or stuff, on when something was available. And another adventure came up, and that was a plane, a Grumman Goose, big amphibious plane, which Fish and Wildlife had several, but this one belonged to another federal agency. I think it might have been BLM, but I don't think, not quite sure about that. At any rate, it had crashed in on top of Bering Glacier. You know where Bering Glacier is?
No.
You know where Malaspina Glacier is, that huge one?
On the Kenai Peninsula?
No, on the coast, just about where the Panhandle begins, north of Yakutat.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's the world's largest Piedmont glacier.
Okay.
It's huge, and it comes right down to the sea. And then another huge one, but it's not quite as big as the Malaspina, just a little further northwest along the coast is Bering Glacier.
Okay.
And... this plane had crashed, and I think everybody was killed. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service had the aircraft division, and they had gone in there and removed the bodies and what. But the plane was there, and the Fish and Wildlife Service was able to get some salvage rights, because they needed parts including engine parts and other parts, and they wanted to go in and salvage some of these. So they wanted to know if I would help them, and they lined up a couple, two or three other young guys that were probably Fish and Wildlife employees, and the pilot flew us down there, and we landed. This was kind of exciting. We landed on the lake on top of the glacier. Now, it was a good pilot, and but it was risky landing in a lake on top of a glacier because there were rocks sticking up in some places, and you couldn't see whether there were rocks. But it looked big enough, and he skimmed first, and finally slowed down, and we landed there and set up a camp. And so we had put up some tents, and we had to hike about a mile on the glacier, which was, it's a glacier that was, by the time it gets down to where it was, it's fairly, you know, fairly rough, but it's not steep mountains coming out of the mountains, and there's, you know, you come to a big crack and you can look down in a crevasse and water's running down there. Some places there's all this moraine on top, lateral moraine that had come from the mountains, and so you'd be walking on gravel, and some of it was tough walking, but it was more solid, you know, and most of the time you didn't have a problem with, we just had hiking boots, and because you could have pretty good traction even on the coarse ice because it was fairly level where you picked your route. So we got up there, and yeah, the mechanics, there were a couple of these were mechanics, and they quickly determined what was, could be salvaged and what we could take back. So we took, we made, once they got to work and freed things up, and we packed this stuff down to the where the plane was, and after the second day, then we had everything that they thought was reasonable to get. Then also, we couldn't overload the plane.
Right.
We had to get off of this lake, and so we loaded it all up, got in the plane, took off, and we, they had enough gas to. Yeah, they had enough gas to get to Anchorage, and that was the plan. So we flew to over Cordova, and we were out over Prince William Sound, and one of the engines on this plane started pumping out oil, and so and big quantities, and so they cut that engine back, and but we were heavy enough loaded, had to find a place to land, so he pulled into a fjord there on the mainland where it wasn't rough and it was relatively calm, and he quickly landed, taxied up to the beach, and he had radioed that what was happening, and got to the Anchorage, I think, but we really didn't know what the situation was on the engine, so went ashore, and they figured, well, it's obviously we're going to have another plane, and then he figured if we unloaded everything, including all the seats and all of our gear and all of the parts on the beach, they could send, and he could put oil back in that one engine that was pumping out the oil, take off, and then he could fly with one engine to Cordova. We were only, you know, 20 miles or so from Cordova. So he flew back to Cordova safely, and then they sent out a beaver, I think, on floats. I had to make a couple trips and took us back to Cordova, And then we eventually got back to Anchorage or wherever I was going, I forget. And they were able to recover that stuff on the beach. And they had to send mechanics over and probably either replace the engine or do the engine work in Cordova,
Or it's still sitting in Cordova.
No, those are valuable planes. They had, that's why they were getting parts. I mean, they were good about keeping these planes flying.
So you were in a Grumman Goose?
No, yeah. We're in a Widgeon.
Oh, a Widgeon.
It was Widgeon, so it's smaller than the Grumman Goose. The Grumman Goose would have been big for that lake, I think.
Yeah.
And
so when was this that you did that?
That was in the second summer.
So summer of 52?
Yeah. And so I fit that in with the other things I was doing. and I got a better feeling for the terrain down there. And that was goat country on the mainland and Cordova area as well. And so I was getting more familiarity with the area, but also getting familiar with the glacier, which I saw some of those from a distance, in the mountains, but not being on top of one was kind of, and at night you'd hear creaks and groans occasionally, which was a little unsettling.
Yeah, it sounds like you didn't really like being on that glacier.
No, nobody did.
No.
And we always thought, too, what happens if that lake drains?
Oh.
The plane would be sitting there and we wouldn't have any way to get off.
And that's true that it does happen with glaciers. They can drain.
Definitely.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at least you had a radio. That is good.
Yeah. We and of course, but to get us off would have been, there weren't that many helicopters around. That would have been a very costly operation.
Yeah. So the mountain goats you were doing while you were working on these sheep surveys, what was your research question? What were you looking at with the mountain goats?
It was, and that was titled this, a reconnaissance study to learn as much as I could, about the general behavior and ecology and their relationship to the habitat, vegetation. But it grew a little more, it was very interesting in many ways. I went into about three study areas on the Kenai where I did most of the work. And not counting the one where we tried to capture goats, I guess certainly learned a lot there, but that wasn't the kind of thing. The other places I was an observer and could watch the goats from a distance that they weren't aware.
So what were your three study areas?
The Cooper Lake area, the mountains around it, and Russian Mountain, which is further to the... It's right on the border of that Cooper Lake is in the National Forest, and then that right at near Cooper Landing. And then the other one was closer to the western edge of those same mountains, near the head of Skilak Lake, mm-hmm. is Russian Mountain. And that was, history was, that was, had been, and Cooper Mountain too, the history had been that those were no mountain goats on Cooper Mountain. There had been mountain sheep only there. There'd, and the same with Russian Mountain. There were still mountain sheep there, but not very many, and some mountain goats. And no mountain goats earlier. But this was based on guide outfitters that had hunted in those areas. And there had been a big decline in mountain sheep populations throughout Alaska, the Kenai, as well as the Denali National Park. And there were all kinds of speculation. One of the ones that was common in some areas was that, especially in Denali, was that there was military pilots would practice gunnery in the mountains with their planes and shoot mountain goats, mountain sheep, rather. But Olaf Murray, Adolf Murray was doing studies there, and there were very severe snow winters in that accounted for this die off the sheep. The sheep populations were had been high because of mild winters and easier vegetation, and they were probably higher than they should be because there had been wolf control in most of these areas. The Denali was National Park was an exception at that time, but in the Kenai there had been the wolves had died out on the Kenai. That's right. Naturally, probably helped by humans, but then they had died out when the first miners, prospectors came into the area. They overwintered. There were caribou that were resident there were totally eliminated. And wolves, these guys trapped, and those days they used poison. It was legal to use poison for killing wolves. Right. And wolf felts were valuable too. And so at that time, about the turn of the century, there were no, it was thought there were no moose on the Kenai. But there was one forester that went there, and he interviewed natives and others, and the moose were apparently there, but so low, and probably because there wasn't much good moose habitat. And there hadn't been a lot of fires. And so these fires occurred, and of course, these miners and prospectors were blamed for the fires, and they probably were responsible for a lot of them. And they were big fires, and they eliminated the good wintering areas for the caribou, but they also lived off this caribou. Mm-hmm. And by this time, the natives probably were hunting them too, but when the Russians were there, the whole focus was on the salmon and the sea. And the native people that lived there lived on the coast where all of the food was. And they didn't, there was no indication that it was forest and not good habitat for moose, closed forests and some of the upland areas where the must have been good caribou range, the lichens were there because of lack of fire, and so the caribou died out and have been reintroduced, and they don't do very well and now because it's totally different habitat. Unfortunately, it's not well documented botanically because no one was there to look at the whole situation. But it's pretty obvious that once these extensive fires occurred, moose habitat was created, and suddenly the moose were all over the place, and big ones, because it was brand new habitat, and there were trophy moose and the early 1900s, these hunters would take, wealthy hunters would come by steamship to Seward, and the guide hunters would take them, meet them, and they would take them by rivers, and then they had horses and would go into the mountains or hunt sheep, and then they would want trophy moose. And so it's a totally different world. And no wolves left. They were gone. Wolves came back on their own through the isthmus there from the Chugach Mountains in the 1960s. In the meantime, the coyotes that had been there suddenly increased. They became a major predator on the mountain sheep young calves.
Hmm. They can get up that high and get them?
They go wherever they can get them. And they're actually a little bit more stable in high country than wolves because they're smaller animals and get, but they, you know, they would, the sheep have to come out in the meadows to feed, and they were, the lambs were vulnerable, particularly vulnerable. But how significant they were in controlling the sheep populations, we don't really know. The sheep were doing quite well.
So you had three study areas. You said Cooper Lake area, Russian Mountain,
and Ptarmigan Lake.
Okay.
And then there was one other place close to Seward called Lost Lake. Up high. You had to hike a long way, but it was a good trail.
Now there's a very popular trail to Lost Lake.
Yeah, right.
But at the time, I guess there was not.
There was a good trail.
Oh, there was already a good trail.
And I think there was one cabin up right about tree line. And in fact, there was a lot of moose right there around tree line. And my friend, the agriculture guy, came down. We exchanged letters, and I said, yeah, if you want to moose hunt this, it's like a good place. So he came down, drove down, and I met him in Seward, and we hiked up this trail. And there had been this one bull that was not too big, but it was like so big. Any bull was legal. And we camped in this cabin. Next morning we get up, there's a bull out there, and he shot it, and we dressed it out. But that was a long hike, even though it was downhill.
Is it how many miles down?
It was about 3 miles.
Yeah.
And it was downhill, and we made two or three trips. But it was nice. And then it was timed with me going back to the campus so that I could ride back with him.
That was Lynn Hollis? Is that who you said his name was?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
So that was nice.
So this is all your summer field work that you were doing?
Yeah, and I... You know, you could fit all these other things in. And I know one time in the fall, right after the moose season opened, and Dave Spencer was off someplace and came flying back in. And he said, well, I don't have to do any flying for about 3 days. And his wife was gone someplace visiting family or something. And you want to go on a moose hunt? Of course, I said, yeah. So we drove out the road toward Moose Pass and in an old burn and hiked into a area where there was a small lake and set up a camp, and next day got a bull and packed it out. I was a good packer.
Yeah. That's why they brought you along. You carry a lot.
Oh, for sure. But that was great. And but I didn't. You know, I was living in a dorm, so I didn't have any great need for moose meat.
But it was still fun to go on the hunts.
Yeah, definitely. That was fun. And I was, you know, anything I do to help Dave, because he was doing flying for me, and he would, you know, sometimes he'd do extra stuff for me for my project. Mm-hmm. He would do goat counts, and sometimes we'd get the land up high in a small lake and spend some time in goat habitat. But I was places I hadn't been able to get to through hiking. And yeah, it was quite accumulated a lot of good observations, and I was able to I did a lot of plant collecting, and so I could identify what was there, and I could see where I could watch goats feeding up, especially Cooper Lake. That was a really good area because I could be on the other side of another ridge watching them, and from a long distance with binoculars. And I had a spotting scope then that belonged to the unit, and I could watch them and seeing where they're feeding, and then I could go over mark it with rocks and stuff, and then go over when the goats moved out of that area and check it out and take notes on what was being eaten and see their fresh droppings and stuff there. And got a lot of good information. And I was able to make some good observations on interaction between sheep and goats. And one of the things, the conclusion that I made, that no one has ever been able to prove it wrong with this. It's strange that, you know, why are there goats in Chugach Mountains, a lot of goats, and some places there's mountain sheep, but only on the western side where it's not so much precipitation. And the goats almost always are restricted to the real steep, heavy precipitation areas. And they get by on cliffs and everything, and showed that their habitat preferences were different, but there's no question, but there'd be overlap areas where there would be good habitat for sheep. Sheep didn't do well on the real cliffy areas, but they liked cliffs when they were having their young, but then they wanted better grazing, whereas the goats are more cosmopolitan in their diet and would browse on shrubs if they were there, or eat fern roots and things that were growing on cliff faces and stuff. And but I remember I was watching this group of females, mountain sheep and lambs primarily, of about 30, a pretty large group. That was on Russian Mountain. And they were in this, where you come down off of sort of more rounded terrain where they would be grazing, but then there was leveled off, and then there was some cliffs there, and the sheep came spilling over, and females were moving down because it looked like that was better watered and it was nice and lush and green, and they're all down there grazing they were already there. There was a group of mountain goat females with young, like there's about a total of 8 counting the young, so there probably would be 4 females and 4 kids. And they were about as large a group as you see of mountain goats. They're not as social as in terms of group size and as mountain sheep. And they were down there feeding in this lush place, and the kids were behaving like any of the young animals. You know, they were having a good time playing and what, and with the longest mom, the moms were close by. And then this group of mountain sheep started coming over there, and it was just a big group. And these ewes stopped and watched. They weren't, I mean, there was no desire to move away or anything, just watch. And they came down, and the sheep were just indifferent to these mountain goats. They're both white creatures, and sheep were not disturbed by the goats being there, and they started feeding, and the lambs were running around, and they started feeding closer and closer to the goats. Finally, the goats started moving away, and then they just moved up and out of the area. And that, I saw this kind of behavior once or twice again, but not as characteristic as that. And the whole strategy of goats is from predator avoidance, is to stay close to the cliffs. If you're up on good grazing, you're just above cliffs, and the predators come, that could be bears or wolves. Then you go over the edge quickly, and you're down on the cliffs, and predators can't handle that mm-hmm. very effectively. And but the sheep, they don't want to go on the real steep cliffs, but they run as a group until they get to more this kind of a slope with big rocks and stuff.
What is that? What angle is that?
45? 45, okay. Yeah. Oh, but whereas the goats are going to be real steep, where there's cliffs when you watch them in these two different habitats, I mean, the goats are real climbers, and they'll let themselves down steep hill on their butts and mm-hmm. use their front feet to keep them going too fast. And you see them, they just go in these places that think it's almost impossible. How can they be up there? And they're just up there to lay down on a ledge or something and munch on a little, especially the big ones. So they're way up high where there's not much vegetation, but yeah, there's a little patch here and they small group size. So say in small group size because it's a food patch, patches are small. Whereas the sheep are different. They need bigger patch size because their group size is big. And being in a group is more confusing to wolves. If they're in your open terrain and you start running, it's more confusing. The wolves have a hard time. And if you don't have to run too far, if you only have to run hundreds of yards, 100 yards or more, then you go into the rocky terrain. And sheep will stay around these kind of slopes that are good grazing, but they stay close to where there's escape terrain. Well, the goats technically are doing the same thing, except they're in escape terrain virtually all of the time.
Hmm.
So there's no indication of aggressive behavior. No one's ever reported that. And between those two, they just don't feel comfortable when they're in the goats when the group is too big. And the reverse is true for the sheep. If they're grazing in a group, they want to be in a bigger group. And that's good. And caribou the same way. You have all these eyes, and so they're not all going to have their head down
right.
at one time feeding, especially in the wintertime when they're digging through the snow. So
that's interesting. I've always wondered why some mountains have goats and some have sheep. Because, you know, of course, right. it all looks the same to me. It's rocky, steep right. mountains. But I didn't realize they could specialize so much.
Yeah. Hmm. They're real specialists. In the Talkeetnas, where they occur, it's like I've flown over it, but I've never been on the ground there. I'd like to get up in there sometime. But it's just not good meadows, lush meadows in the alpine area. It's rocky and boulders and boulder piers and steep cliffs. And that's where the goats are. And the sheep, there's virtually no sheep in that area.
Hmm.
But they're close by. And the goats, why haven't the goats spread out when the sheep populations go down? It's apparently a terrain characteristic that are very important for the goats.
Yeah, the goats don't want to go over into those
right.
meadows. And
there's been one authenticated observation of a goat in Denali National Park. And it was Adolf Murray made the observation, so... And he, you know, he studied mountain goats. And
he kind of knew what he was talking about.
He knew what he was talking about. And it was crossing a road, and there were no sheep or other goats around. And that was Then there was a mountain in near Cantwell. There is a mountain near Cantwell that's called Goat Mountain. And the local legend is that a goat was seen there once. And that's relatively close to this place in, across the valley in the Talkeetna's where there's goats. Well, you know, goats and young animals frequently wander off and disperse long distances. That's how they get from one place to another. Mm-hmm.
But so there are not goats in Denali. Those are all sheep.
Yeah. A lot of people, you know, that go into, even informed people sometimes make the mistake. They see all these pictures of the big sheep.
With the curled antlers.
And then they see their first female and they think it's a goat. Because the horns are only about this long on the female.
What is that, 8 inches?
They're very...
So the big curls on the sheep, those are the males?
Yeah, always males, yeah.
Oh.
And females are much smaller. And the males, you know, the males, as well as the bighorns down in the Rockies, when the breeding period, they charge one another and kabang!
Yeah, they hit their heads.
And it banks off, and you can hear that from some distance. It's quite a thing. We skied into... to Denali on the north side, on off of Stampede Trail, mm-hmm. one time, with Ed Murphy and Ken Whitten, and it was in early December when they're rutting. We had terrific weather, and it was very mild, and not windy. And yeah, we got up. It wasn't the greatest place to get close, but we got enough so with binoculars, we could watch some of this and you could hear the horns banging together. And it was, I remember we were up there watching these and then we heard this bird, we thought. And what bird could that be? This was in December and we couldn't figure it out. And finally, there was this rock stick up through the snow. And that was a pika.
Oh.
And, well, you know that they're active all winter long under the snow when they're feeding on their hay piles.
Mm-hmm.
But this was nice weather, and there was a little bit of sun still shining in the sky. And this thing, it was out there, and it was whistling at us. And it was far enough away so that it was felt secure because it dipped back down. But it was interesting that it came out, you know, to view the real world. And
so instead of a bird, it was a pika.
Yeah.
How funny.
Yeah.
But the sheep were banging their heads together in December? I thought that was a mating.
It is mating. It's early December. They have a gestation period that's much shorter than moose or caribou.
Oh, okay.
And yeah. So it was, so they mate in early December, and then they have their young in May.
Oh. And what about goats? The same?
It's about the same.
Hmm. Well, so it sounds like you're... goat research then made an important contribution.
Yeah, but those days you didn't, there wasn't real pressure to publish your master's thesis. I just had so many, 2 copies of the library and one, and they all had to be typed. And the copy you ended up with is hardly readable, and you had to pay for the binding.
And so you wrote it all longhand.
No, I had a, yeah, that's part of my graduate program there. I had a little portable typewriter that would belong to my father.
Mm.
And you had to have strong fingers, you know.
A manual typewriter.
And, well, you had to went to uppercase you had to push down in this whole carriage and bring up all the keys and stuff. But I had that, plus we had, I took a course in typing, and so did virtually all these other wildlife students that were my buddies. We took this course in typing, and that was very helpful. I got so that I was moderately good typer, and I typed out the draft myself. And then I gave it to, had to hire a woman secretary for one of the administrators or something, and they would type it, and they paid them so much by the hour. And that's, for me, by the time I finished up, I had to, I didn't have enough money to pay this. I had to get a student loan of $200. And that was about the smallest amount you could get, but I needed that much money to pay for the typist and a few other things.
The binding.
The binding, yeah, you had to pay for the binding. And but I they didn't have a lot of money to loan students in those days, but this wasn't a lot of money either.
The way you paid for your, did you ever get one of those research grants? Did they ever have money?
The second year I got, that was paid for my tuition. I had the TI bill for, paid so much, some of my living costs and tuition. So that was a good deal, and and then I did these other jobs that I needed, but I got by okay, and it's when you paid so much a semester, and especially if you were eating in the cafeteria. You didn't have a lot of money, but you didn't really need a lot of money. Now, what you suffered from is you didn't have the kind of money. I mean, I was into photography, and I didn't have enough money to buy a decent camera. And so I'd buy these old used cameras that were pretty good cameras, but they usually had some malfunction of some kind.
But so you made money in the summer working on those surveys. Your animal husbandry job, your pasteurization.
I didn't make any money on, when I was working for the sheep surveys, then I got paid something as technician. When I was flying on goat surveys, I was living off of my stipend.
Right. That stipend was that grant money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you did get that.
And I got so much a month from the stipend, but I think that's the way it paid out. And then there was a little left over, but not much, for research grants. And like that, recovering that equipment from the glacier, they gave me aircraft time.
Oh, in exchange.
So that was that I could draw on.
Right.
And that was really good. So then I could ask Dave or somebody else that was available for some flight time. And there were a few other pilots that would be in and out.
But your job with the milk pasteurizing, that was just that first winter? Or did you keep doing that?
I think I kept doing that. It was a good, it fit in with other coursework and stuff, and it was good income. Any more income was important.
Yeah. So you did that for a couple years, or?
During the academic year, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't do it. I just did it in the academic year. I don't know what they did in the summer. They may not have had, the cafeteria might not have been open in the summer, I don't know. I don't think it was, because I know sometime in the summer we didn't we didn't. Maybe that was the first summer. The second. I don't know.
Yeah, you weren't here in the summers. You were out in the field.
When I was working in the deep survey work in the White Mountains and the Alaska Range, then I was based on campus, and I think I was still living in the dorm.
Oh, okay.
During the summer for that, and then I didn't stay in the dorm. But there was a period when, and I think that must have been the first year, when we, I remember we were, one of us was renting, we weren't, that was before we moved into the main dorm, I think. When we were, that's where I was writing the thesis there. But before that, after that first year, maybe, I don't think we had, and I was doing some work in the summer, but I don't think we had we could stay in a vet's dorm. I think they were doing maintenance, they couldn't stay there, and maybe they were getting rid of them or something. And we rented a place that was called down where about where the power plant is now,
mm-hmm.
down in the valley.
You mean the university power plant?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a power plant then.
Right.
That was over the old, by the mines building. But it, then that was called Vulture Flats, I think, that area. And it's distinct from the college corner post office, mm-hmm. and what. And there was a old, it had been a house, and it was run down, and somebody, it was not a house, it was just a big frame cabin or something, but it had a, it was a small frame cabin, let's put it, it had a separate kitchen or something, and it was tilted at the angle. And I remember we had one person had permission to use it, and so we'd hang out down there, and we were cooking our own food. That's when we were really on a Spartan diet. That's right, and because we didn't have much money, I wasn't on the stipend. And the others had some stipend money, but not everybody else did, and so. We'd buy cheapest food we could get, but we were meat eaters, and so we'd buy horse meat at Piggly Wiggly.
Piggly Wiggly, yeah.
And it was marked fit for human consumption, but it was mostly dog mushers that were buying it. But it was frozen, and you could buy big chunks, and it wasn't, and we chopped it up and made spaghetti out of it, and it was great. I don't know where the horses came from. And we harvested what we could in the wild then, and maybe if somebody got something, we shared it. And but I don't think in the winter time did we. I think by the winter we went back. That's when we went back into the dorm.
So that was just in the summertime.
I think so. Yeah.
So were you eating grouse and
grouse.
Ptarmigan?
Yeah, and fish.
Fish.
Yeah.
Is that when you bought fish at the? You were talking earlier about the whole fish.
Yeah, we bought those occasionally at Piggly Wiggly, yeah.
From Birch Lake? Is that where the guy was catching them?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whitefish.
Right. But it was a different world, and the things that we used, a lot of the stuff that we could use in the going in the field, too, like powdered whole milk.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in a big can. And you know, we couldn't afford fresh milk.
No. Nobody
right.
did back then.
And we go in the field, we could get powdered eggs, whole eggs powdered. You mix that with the powdered whole milk real well, and then you could make sort of like an omelet or something, and with you could throw chunks of meat or bacon or something in with it, and it was quite edible. But the flavor was there.
Well, yeah, I was going to say your field rations were probably a little different back then than what people eat today.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No fancy dehydrated foods?
No, they didn't have any of that. The standards were you could get, you'd take rice, was standard. You could get this bacon that lasted forever, you know, it was smoked and cured and hung.
Mm.
And it was just terrific bacon. You can't get anything like that nowadays. It's called get water added and what. And that was good to take in the field. And even in the summer, you take a small chunk of it. And then you could get some of this, like, sausage, smoked sausage. That was pretty expensive, but you could get that. And cheese. Cheese was very important. And and then you could get ham and those kind of things. So this one of the students in the unit program, he was an undergraduate then, but he went on, and that was Ron Skoog, who later became commissioner of Fish and Game, and he did the PhD study on caribou. One of the classic ones, and he was a nice guy. He was a tough field guy, and in those days, you know, we'd go off by ourselves often. So he was working on caribou in the, that was when he was working for his master's on caribou. He was working in the East 40 Mile area out on the was at the Taylor Highway out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so he plan was to drive out there, he wanted to know what the caribou were doing in the shortest period of winter, coldest period of winter. And so he drove out there, and he had a tent and back, and he had to put together all of his food. So in the old Maine, I remember him packaging up these foods. He wanted everything as efficient as possible because he realized he had to cook with one of these little gas one-burner stoves and pack this stuff, all the food and everything. And I don't know whether he was using skis or not. He probably had snowshoes. People weren't using skis then. And had, snowshoes. He drove as far as he could go, and then he walked. So he walked into the area where he would be able to see the caribou. And he was gone for about a week. And then so he had all this food packaged and everything. And when he was putting it together, he wanted as simple as possible. You know, one thing he had to eat for all meals was rice. And then he'd cut up this old-fashioned ham, which was nice and dry,
mm-hmm.
and he'd into chunks. He put that certain amount of those in with a plastic bag, and they'd wrap the plastic bag, and it. Each one of those was a meal, and he had those all laid out there, all with the same amount. And so he didn't have to worry about what meal it was. It was all the same. He just loved rice and ham.
Mm-hmm.
He just loved it. He put some salt and pepper or something in there too. But then all he had to do was heat up the water, dump this in, and cook it. And it was old-fashioned kind of rice, so it took a while. But he'd do that. And so we said, you know, Ron, you're going to get damn tired of that. Oh, I'd never be tired of this. I'd love it. And it's just so much more efficient this way and the way I do it. And so he took off. And the two things happened. One is when he came back, I said, I'm never going to eat ham and rice again. He got tired of it. The other thing, he came back and he realized he had slept through a whole day. The days were so short. It was cold. He had a good sleeping bag and he had a watch of some kind. And he said he woke up and it was still dark and he went back to sleep. And he was good at sleeping. And he woke up again, still dark. Night was long. He woke up again, and the sun was up. And he didn't. And he kept notes every day. So he was one day off when he came back. He had slept through one whole day.
Well, you only had 4 hours.
I know.
And so if you didn't wake up in those 4 hours, then how would you know?
Right. When he says,
great field work.
Right. And he came back and suddenly, it was a day off.
It's funny.
He had a good sense of humor. He did. He went out in some of these sheep camps with me. That's down in the Sugach Mountains. It was a fun guy. It's a good guy to be with in the field.
So what other things were your field rations? Was there like dried vegetables or onions or something? Or didn't take fresh. Well, you did your field work mostly in the summer, right?
If you're in the mountains, you focus on, you don't get too fancy on dried vegetables and stuff. You have something, and you could get dehydrated peas and peas and carrots, things like that. To me, when you cooked them up, you know, they tasted very much like the package.
They still tasted dehydrated.
It's got a lot of the freeze-dried stuff is like that anyway.
Yeah.
But at any rate, chocolate. Mm-hmm. And I used to take, you know, the semi-sweet and big chunks. And that was great stuff. You had to, you know, and for lunch, if you're doing a lot of hiking, then you would want real concentrated stuff. And that includes raisins or dates or figs. But you'd want cheese. And if you had to take, you wanted some kind of bread or carbohydrates, your pilot crackers were okay because there wasn't any bread that would keep in those days.
What about nuts? Did you take nuts?
I think so, but I don't think there were. Normally, you couldn't find them in the store.
Oh.
Already shelled nuts.
Yeah. Huh.
They were seasonal. You could get things and pecans and you crack them for around Thanksgiving or Christmas. But then let's see what else.
They didn't have peanut butter probably to take like they do now.
They had peanut butter, I'm pretty sure, but any glass or thing like that, you wouldn't want to take. If you're going out for camping and you're from the road we often worked during the hunting season on checking stations, and we could usually have meat associated with being out there from hunters. Or we could take a caribou ourselves and hang it up in the fall in a tree or something and cut. That was nirvana.
That's not like all your survey work where you're hiking around in the mountains.
No.
You had different. To carry everything yourself?
Yeah.
Or did you have a base camp?
Some of both, but mostly you would have a base camp up high for the mountain sheep work. But how that got up there varied. Sometimes you had to carry it all the way up.
Oh. Okay.
Other places, like some of the work we did down in the Chukuk and the Chugach by Anchorage, above Eagle River and mm-hmm. that area, we had the military. They talked the military into flying us in with the helicopter.
Right.
And the one time they sent a guy, or the military didn't like the idea of flying one person in there and leaving them all by themselves. And so they sent a young enlisted man in, and he was a fun kid. Fun guy, and he was wasn't much younger than I was, but he was a fun guy, and he had his birthday in there. He told me after he got in there, and I figured because we were brought in by the helicopter, I had some pancake flour or something like that, so I made this birthday cake, and we had candles too. Or fire starter, or at night. And so I had this one candle in the center, and we took a picture of him with his birthday cake. That was fun. He was a fun guy.
Well, it sounds like you had some fun.
Yeah. Oh, I did have one problem in the Chugach Mountain, a trip where I was by myself. And I had, how did I get in there? I think I hiked in. I know I had to hike out. Yeah, I hiked in. And so I went pretty light. And I had just a tiny pup tent, and camped up high. And I found this freshly dead lamb. And I packed it back to the camp, and I think I found it the day before it was going to be taken out. No, a couple of days. That's right. I might have had some plastic bags or something. And so I think I put it in a plastic bag, and I thought, what killed it? I couldn't see any evidence that it had been attacked by a predator, and it was hadn't been there too long. And so I think I put it in a snowbank to keep it fresh, and then away from my tent, because there were bears up there. But the bears hadn't found it. And so I put it in there. And then the next day, when I woke up, I had an infection in my eye. And it got worse. And so it was kind of awkward, because I was, using a spotting scope and watching these sheep and doing counts, and I thought, this is, I hope it doesn't get much worse, because I still have to hike out, which I did. Or maybe that time the helicopter was coming to get me. I forget about that. It might have been. At any rate, I was by myself, and so finally, I was only a couple of days with the eye infection, and then the helicopter came and took me back to Anchorage, and so I they were sold right away. I wanted to go to a doctor, and they said, yeah, you definitely should. And especially, they thought maybe this sheep lamb, they wanted them to check that out.
Yeah.
And so they took that to some lab where they were, I think it was a public health service lab, and to examine that. And in the meantime, I went to a doctor, and the doctor looked at it, and he said he thought it was a kind of eye infection that is not uncommon, but they said he thinks it was also common in animals. And so it might have been where I got this, and gave me some drugs and eye drops and things, which I used right correctly, and it cleared it up. And I think then in the diagnosis of the lamb, they said that was likely had an infection that was an eye infection as well. But they couldn't say for sure that that's what killed it, or why it got the infection. But I didn't see any other sign that that was a problem. But yeah. That was a little unnerving because yeah. It was in one eye. If it got into the other, it would...
I didn't realize that there could be things that would transfer. And I didn't realize that there are diseases that would be transferable from a sheep to a human.
Things like that, eye infection, yeah, that would be quite possible, mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, you were lucky.
Yeah.
You mentioned bears, and I wanted to ask you, when we were talking about the food and you're taking out bacon and ham, and I'm thinking, okay, you're going into bear country. Did you have bear problems?
No, not really. Well, first place, most of everything was kept in plastic bags. And if we had, most of the time we would put, if there was a snowbank, we would put the food in the snowbank, anything that, but most of the things were so dry, and probably that bacon, we wouldn't take bacon in a situation like that, in the mountains where you're camping out. So, and if you had a summer sausage, you know, you had it in a plastic bag, and kept it in that, and just sliced it off, and then sealed it up again, and put all of the this food out. But you had to be careful about the food too, because there are ground squirrels and that can get into everything. So you might have to pile rocks over it so the ground squirrels couldn't get in. And if you ground squirrels would try to get into your tent, then generally we had a mosquito-proof tent, but you didn't zip it down properly, ground squirrel could get in there, get in the food, and then it's hard to get them out without creating problems.
Yeah.
And they get more blatant as you stay in one place for any length of time if there's any food scraps around. But, you know, we were conscientious about not having food in your tent.
Yeah.
Unless, in some cases, we maybe figured there wasn't any other option and you just had to sleep with the gun.
Oh, yeah.
You always had a rifle or bear gun, potentially, with you.
So did you ever have any interactions with bears?
Yeah, a few, but the only ones that I know of that I can recall from that sheep work was I was hiking in the Talkeetna Mountains on a trail down moderately low, and that was in midsummer, I think. And this was a trail that had been used for horses, for hunters, to get into this country. And it was lower hills with a lot of dwarf birch and some willows, and then streams where there were willows would be more common. But the vegetation was mostly only about this high.
4 feet?
Or less, yeah. And it was kind of hilly, so there would be not good visibility too far up ahead. So I was hiking there, I think, going in, and I came around the bend in the trail, and there was a bear in the trail, and it was, pretty sure it was a small grizzly, and it wasn't a big grizzly, and it was like diagonally, the trail went down around, it was going down to go across a little stream, and so it was coming up this trail, and then and we saw one another about the same time, and I was carrying my rifle hooked over my kilty frame, and so first thing I did was take it off my shoulder and put a shell in the chamber, and then stand there and watch this thing. Oh, and then the next thing I wanted to do is grab my camera. But then it started coming up the trail, and it was acting curious, and so I weighed my items a little bit, and you know, talked lowly, like, "Hey, you don't come up here," or something like that, and it kept acting curious, and so then, and it stopped for a minute, and was just there, and I thought, and that there was a clump of sod, and I reached down and I picked that up, and I threw it, and it landed right on its back. I threw it up in a big arc, and landed on its back. I thought if it landed in front of him, you know, it might frighten him a little bit, but it landed on his back, and I could tell he felt it, but it was a sod, it was pretty soft, but it didn't faze him at all. And so then I started thinking, and it started coming again, and I thought, how close do I let it come before it? For I hadn't studied up much on bluff charges and stuff like that, and so I didn't want to shoot this bear, and I did. And even in those days, if you shot a bear in self-defense, you got to skin the thing out too and report it. So I would come and screw me up. I'd have to go back out again. And, but by this time, I got the thing up there, and I feel, you know, when should I start to squeeze this goddamn trigger? And finally, just when it was probably a little closer than I should have let it come, if to be totally safe, it stopped. Must have gotten my smell and turned around, and it just ran back down the trail and then off into the brush and disappeared over the. I saw it some distance away, going and running away. And I've had some other ones similar to that, but that one was a bit unnerving because I hadn't had much experience with bears that close to pay attention to me.
Yeah, sounds scary. Those bluff charges, yeah, well, I've not had to deal with that, but it sounds scary.
I had one after I was working down in the southeast. We'll leave that till later.
Okay, I think we should stop for tonight.
Yeah,
okay.
That sounds
good.
That's
a good place to stop.